Diane Perry was a lively young woman from East London who loved stilettos, dancing, and Elvis Presley.
I need somebody to lean on. I need somebody to tell my troubles to. No use denying.
But the bubbly 20-year-old had a hidden depth to her, one that would lead her to a cave 13,000 feet high in the Himalayas. It was here that she embraced her new life as a Buddhist nun, and where she would spend 12 years in dedicated seclusion. Her living quarters were cosy yet Spartan. Measuring 10 feet wide by 6 feet deep, the cave housed a small wood burning stove, images of Buddhist icons, and a wooden meditation box. In this box, Diane Perry, now Tenzin Palmo, would enter into uninterrupted spiritual practice. She slept only 3 hours a night in a seated, meditative posture. In the biographical book Cave in the Snow by Vicky McKenzie, Tenzin Palmo conveys how it was only through her seclusion that she could uncover her true reality and re-emerge on a new path.
To my mind, worldly life is an escape. In a cave, however, you have no one to turn to but yourself. In a cave, you face your own nature in the raw. You have experiences of great intensity, times when your body completely melts away, or when you feel your body is flying. There are states of incredible bliss. Bliss is the fuel of retreat. It marks just the stage of a journey. The ultimate goal is to realize the nature of the mind. And to do that, one has to go away and practice, to reap the fruits of the path. Otherwise, you have nothing to give anyone else.
Tenzin Palmo came out of the cave determined to give other women like her the opportunity to embrace the spiritual path. After years in seclusion, Palmo set her sights on women's spiritual liberation. She became a passionate global speaker, travelling from Asia to America to raise funds for a groundbreaking nunnery where, for the first time, women could formally perfect the art of Buddhist discipline. Tenzin Palmo's path of seclusion is remarkable for an urban Western woman, especially when I consider how the modern world is geared towards connectivity and communication. Seclusion can be deeply powerful. Throughout centuries, individuals of various faiths, cultures, and disciplines have shown that seclusion is the key to unlock not only the mysteries of the self and the divine, but is also the key to social revolution and human progress. In today's constantly connected world, finding solitude has become a lost art. In fact, Western culture tends to equate a desire for solitude with people who are lonely, sad, or have antisocial tendencies. But seeking solitude can actually be quite healthy. There are many physical and psychological benefits to spending time alone. Seekers of all faith traditions have been drawn to solitude as a way of deepening their understanding and, in most cases, helping others. Fourteen centuries before Palmo entered her cave, Prophet Muhammad retreated into a cave in the mountain of Hira in Mecca to reflect on the nature of the divine and to seek refuge from the injustices of tribal practice. This moment is described as a second birth by Barnaby Rogerson in his biography of Prophet Muhammad.
Muhammad was to be born twice in Mecca. 40 years after he first entered the world as a human being, he pierced another dimension and entered sacred space. His sacred second birth took place in a cave on the slopes of Mount Hira.
It was through the window of seclusion that he found his calling to be a leader, to pioneer in social justice, and to be an activist for human rights. Yet that first revelation was soul-shattering. Muhammad was gripped with self-doubt, fear, and uncertainty. His first reaction was to retreat further into himself. He beckoned his beloved wife, Khadija, cover me," wrapping himself under the concealing folds of his cloak. Yet doubt served as a bridge to strengthen his conviction for the turbulent road ahead. I feel that to doubt is to be human. My own dark moments of doubt have led me to more clarity of purpose. And doubt was not unfamiliar to arguably the most influential Muslim thinker who ever lived, Imam al-Ghazali. The 11th century-born Persian scholar was at the height of his fame when he suffered a spiritual crisis. His doubts led him away from a high position at the Sultan's court to a simple life of seclusion. It was in this period that he became an active Sufi and produced his greatest work, Ihya Ulum al-Din, The Revival of the Religious Sciences. The academics Muhammad Rosmizi and Saleh Yasil describe this period of solitude.
Al-Ghazali claims that during this seclusion phase, things innumerable and unfathomable were revealed to him. Seclusion produced a new Al-Ghazali. The jurist and theologian had become a practicing and enlightened Sufi. If in the phase of seclusion Al-Ghazali was personal, namely focused on personal reformation, devotion, and inner spiritual self, the phase after seclusion marked the beginning of an active spiritual public life. This new Al-Ghazali actively enlightened every class of society, the public, elites, theologians, philosophers, mystics, and others, through teachings, writings, and by sharing his personal spiritual experience. Al-Ghazali is historically unique. There is no known scholar in Islamic history who could produce works in various fields that influenced the Muslim and the Western world to such an extent.
It was due to the many profound truths Imam al-Ghazali uncovered in his seclusion that led to a ripple effect of influence on minds, on thought, and on society. His works influenced some of the greatest philosophers of the Western world, the Dominican friar St. Thomas Aquinas, as well as the Italian poet Dante and the Jewish philosopher Maimonides. For thinkers like Ghazali, going into seclusion was a male privilege, while for many women throughout history, it was a claustrophobic space walled up by patriarchy. This is what Isabella Bird discovered when she visited Korea in 1894. The intrepid English explorer and writer had already travelled through America, Japan, Persia and Kurdistan before she entered Korea. Here, she observed that elite Korean women were more secluded than any other women she had encountered in her extensive travelling.
Absolute seclusion is the inflexible rule among the upper classes. Korean women are very rigidly secluded, perhaps more absolutely than the women of any other nation. At about 8 o'clock, the great bell tolled a signal for men to retire into their houses and for women to come out. So it was at the time of my arrival, and the pitch-dark streets presented the singular spectacle of being tenanted solely by bodies of women with servants carrying lanterns. At 12, the bell again boomed. The women retired, and men were at liberty to go abroad. A lady of high position told me that she had never seen the streets of Seoul by daylight.
Enforced seclusion was suffocating for Korean noblewomen, yet seclusion found a different expression for the women of the imperial harem in the Ottoman Empire, where, although confined to the palace, they had political influence, nurtured strategic relationships, and became highly skilled in poetry and music. Thank you. Undoubtedly, the most famous woman of the Ottoman harem was none other than Sultan Hürrem, or Roxelana. Shrewd, intelligent, and lively, Roxelana soon became Suleiman's favourite concubine and controversially his wife, breaking with centuries of harem protocol and tradition that dictated the Sultan would never marry. Roxelana was Suleiman's advisor and was hugely influential on Ottoman affairs. Her achievements from the seclusion of the harem was a remarkable feat in a man's world. But it was helped by the nature of the imperial harem, which carved out its own space of influence. It was a locus of power where outsiders sought to form ties with potential patrons in the palace. In her book, The Imperial Harem, Leslie Pierce observes,
"The segregation of the sexes permitted the articulation of a hierarchy of status and authority among women, parallel to that which existed among men. It was the first time in Ottoman history that a former concubine could wield so much power in the dynasty."
Roxelana established madrasas, a women's hospital, and soup kitchens. And as a fascinating figure, she became the stuff of legend, fueling imaginings in literature, plays, and even inspired the music of the Austrian classical composer Joseph Haydn in his Symphony No. 63, known as La Roxelane. Haydn was among the first teachers of Beethoven, the volatile German composer who famously suffered from hearing loss. When he first realised his condition, his frustrations morphed into booming insults to those around him. He decided it was time to withdraw from all society and go into seclusion. And what strikes me most is that through the transitory phase of seclusion, Beethoven was to produce some of the most extraordinary music of his life. The struggle of his seclusion gave birth to a new calling. Determined to overcome his illness, Beethoven wrote his famous symphonies, including the Third Symphony, which was a milestone in classical music, and twice as long as the symphonies of Mozart and of his former teacher, Haydn. The American composer and author Jan Swofford, in his biography of Beethoven entitled Anguish and Triumph, writes,
"The crisis did not forge the new path, but rather made it mandatory. There would be no more of trying this and that. It was do or die. And for Beethoven now, that was no metaphor. It was the simple truth. In all things with Beethoven, the stronger the challenge, the more aggressive and outsized his response. The depth of his despair was answered by the opposite forces of his will, his courage, his defiance of fate. He struggled for greater unity and at the same time greater diversity than any composer had aspired to before. He could only have felt the time was right. After the darkest night of the soul he had experienced in Helgenstadt, the world of music seemed to be holding out its arms and beckoning him to the future."
Beethoven's seclusion heralded a new path and a new age. It was a rite of passage. Such rites of passage are crucial to the ancient practice of Aboriginal Australians, whose walkabout in the wilderness for 6 months in total seclusion marks their transition from boy to man. Amid the ancient landscape, alone but united with the Australian plains, they would trace the songlines, paths that the legendary beings wandered through in the Dreamtime, which was an understanding of the world, of its creation and its great stories. They would sing out the name of every animal, plant and rock. They were singing the world into existence.
The ancestral beings sang as they formed the land. They left songs as a record of their doings, teaching them to their human offspring. It is believed that performing the right songs and ceremonies at particular points along a ritual track gives people direct access to the dreaming. Dreaming is a complex network of faith, knowledge, and ritual that dominates all spiritual and practical aspects of Aboriginal life. The dreaming lays down the structures of society, rules for social behaviour and ceremonies to increase the land's fertility. The dreaming comes from the land.
The bond these young Aboriginal boys felt with the land makes me contemplate the story of another, even younger boy who embraced nature in the seclusion of the forest. Prince Dhruva, in the Hindu tradition, was only 5 years old when he was denied the kingdom and his father's love by his stepmother, who told him he could only reclaim his stake in the kingdom if he found the supreme figure of Godhead. So Prince Dhruva searched for God in the forest. He cultivated extraordinary spiritual energy, becoming so at one with nature in his yearning for God, that when he suspended his breath, the breath of the universe suspended with him. The power of Dhruva's mindfulness was so intense that Lord Vishnu then appeared to him in all his divine glory. The prince fell prostrate, relinquishing all his material goals, yet Vishnu granted him kingship over the entire earth for thousands of years. I find Dhruva fascinating, because secluding the mind like he did harnessed the silent power of the inner self, which in turn reverberated through the world. Dr. Bruce Davis, an author and a silent retreat leader, argues that it is only through the silence of seclusion that we can tap into our optimum creativity.
The best of our creativity emerges out of the valleys and mountaintops of the silence inside of us. Silence and creativity are perfect partners. Silence gives to our creativity, and creativity gives to what we find in the silence. A tapestry of trust develops where the unseen can be given form, the unknown can be discovered. The creative process is most at work when there is silence outside and peace and quiet within. In the deep and pure well of our being, real creativity takes place.
Dr. Davis rightly observes that great writers, thinkers, innovators begin in silence. And one of our greatest scientific thinkers of all time was the quiet genius of Nikola Tesla, the Serbian-American inventor and engineer. Tesla was born in the 19th century, but was the father of the 20th. His discoveries and inventions brought immense progress to the world. He gave us fluorescent light bulbs, X-rays, wireless connections, and the radio, among so many others. Tesla led a secluded life, engaged in continuous, concentrated thought and deep meditation. He even shied from relationships, deciding to remain a bachelor, focusing entirely on scientific endeavour. He observed that
the mind is sharper and keener in seclusion and uninterrupted solitude. No big laboratory is needed in which to think. Originality thrives in seclusion, free of outside influences beating upon us to cripple the creative mind. Be alone. That is the secret of invention. Be alone. That is when ideas are born. That is why many of the earthly miracles have had their genesis in humble surroundings.
Tesla's words are deeply resonant. What he gave to the world is immeasurable. The seclusion of one man amounted to progress for humankind. Tesla's philosophical words are a welcome echo to those of the medieval Muslim poet and scholar Jalal ad-Din Rumi, who wrote,
"Why are you so afraid of silence? Silence is the root of everything. If you spiral into its void, 100 voices will thunder messages you long to hear."
The Benedictine nuns of Notre Dame with communion panis. The sisters live in complete seclusion in the south of France, near Avignon. They remain inside the convent until death. The voices Rumi describes speak to me of all the various chants and repetitions that form the spirit of meditative practice across different faiths and cultures. The Gregorian chants, the Sufi dhikrs, the Buddhist meditations all reflect a yearning and a discovery of spiritual paths. They lead us deep within the paths of our own souls, from where we can re-emerge to impact the wider world. There is a seclusion even in the collective nature of chanting. Seclusion becomes their common ground where voices join in harmony. The Persian poet Hafiz tells us to embrace solitude at a deeper level.
Don't surrender your loneliness so quickly. Let it cut more deep. Let it ferment and season you, as few human or even divine ingredients can. Something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender. My need of God absolutely clear.
My own personal time of seclusion is a practice that goes back to the 7th century, when Prophet Muhammad secluded himself in the last third of the night before the break of dawn to worship his Lord. This voluntary prayer is known in Arabic as tahajjud, which means to give up sleep. And it does feel like the world is dreaming while I leave the warmth of my bed, perform the ritual ablution, stand, bow, and touch my forehead to the ground in devotion. Wrapped in silence and the veils of night, there is only me, my Creator, my prayers. It's a tranquil and sacred time where Muslims believe that God draws closest to creation and responds to all who call out to their Lord. The intimacy of this secluded spiritual experience brings my body, mind, heart, and soul into harmony. It's a moment of clarity, a moment of love. Whenever I perform the night prayer, it's like therapy for my soul. It renews my spirit, strengthens my bond with God, and readies me to navigate the challenges of life. My lips utter the opening words of the Quran before the dawn opens another day.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, Maliki Yawmiddin, Iyaka Na'budu wa Iyaka Nasta'een. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Seclusion is centering, powerful, and revelatory. As I reflect upon the seclusion of Prophet Muhammad that prepared him for tremendous challenges, or the Buddhist nature of self-realization that led Tenzin Palmo to become a spiritual activist, or the inventions of Nikola Tesla which found true genius in solitude, I comprehend that seclusion breeds inspiration, creativity, and radical change, both for the self and for the world. If it were experienced more widely, I wonder at its effect. We could have the capability to influence society with insight, with compassion, with realization of who we are and what we're here for. I can only feel that seclusion is one of humanity's greatest allies. Seclusion is the place where I could truly live.
The solitude sometimes is that place that I would like to live. Solitude sometimes is where nothing really seems to fit. If black were truly black, not gray, it might provide some depth to pray. To black out all the words of men and demons too, but not even them. A solitude sometimes is.